Okay, sorry for the uncomfortable silence. Wanted to say thank you guys so much for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure to be back in Santa Barbara, where I went to undergrad. And I'm going to give you sort of an overview of some of the work I do at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Two programs I'm involved in, the Ultrafast Materials Program and the Quantum Materials Program. A third one in spin dynamics, actually, which is more relevant. This Ultrafast Materials Program does all manner of ultrafast spectroscopy, and I just wanted to give you an overview because to get people thinking about what types of experiments we might be able to do that would be of interest to you. Ultrafast lasers from terahertz to x-rays, ultrafast angle-resolved photoemission, ultrafast x-ray absorption and scattering. We study all sorts of materials other than just spintronics-related materials as well. We have growth people who grow single crystals. We have people doing thin films of oxides and all sorts of stuff. And this is our beautiful view from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. The picture was taken a few years ago, so we now have a brand new $6 billion Bay Bridge. So I recommend you come check it out and drive over it. It's very exciting. So I want to try to talk about sort of two different ideas here. One is experiments on the 2D Fermi gas and gallium arsenide. So the idea here is as simple a system as we can come up with in the lab. It can be grown so precisely that we can really engineer the physics we're interested in, the spin orbit coupling, things like that. The other is quantum materials. We do a lot of work on cuprates. I'm going to talk a little about skirmion spin textured materials, and we're really excited about a lot of new work on iridates. I'll touch on that at the very end a little bit. So the basic idea in ultrafast spectroscopy is it's usually stroboscopic measurements, so some sort of pump to excite the sample and a probe to then measure what the pump did. So very much like stroboscopic photography. Here, a photograph of a coin being flipped. And this idea was actually invented by the Bay Area's very own Leland Stanford. He actually came up with this in order to win a bet. He had a bet with his friends about whether the legs of a horse all were ever off the ground at the same time while running. And you know, Leland Stanford had a lot of money, so he was able to actually set this up. He set up cameras all around his track to take pictures of the horse as it was running by. So this was not a camera moving with him, but cameras set up around the track, and he was able to make this sort of first movie in real time, showing that, in fact, all the horse's legs were off the ground at one time, and Leland Stanford won yet again. So what we do nowadays is, you know, using titanium-doped sapphire lasers, you get lasing over a very broad bandwidth so that you can use these lasers to make femtosecond pulses of light. You make trains of femtosecond pulses of light, which you can then use to pump and probe your sample, and you can very accurately vary the time delay between these two pulse trains. Okay, so like I said, you can use photons that range from terahertz to x-rays. You can use photons in, e-beam out. You can actually emit electrons from your sample and do time-resolved, angle-resolved photoemission. This is actually, from the Shen group here, is the best angle-resolved photoemission movie ever produced, I think. It's showing a charge density wave amplitude mode in real time. And you can even do ultrafast electron diffraction, ultrafast electron microscopy. I mean, anything you can think of, you can sort of put the word ultrafast in front of, and we can find a way to do it. So the system I want to talk about first is just this 2D Fermi gas and gallium arsenide, okay? So it's as simple as it gets. You have a quantum well where all your electrons that you dope into the well sit in the ground state of the well. And then in the plane, you have free electrons with free electron dispersion, and then the addition of spin orbit coupling, which is highly controllable and tunable in gallium arsenide. So gallium arsenide is also the perfect match for the TISAF laser, which is resonant with the band gap of gallium arsenide. And the symmetry of gallium arsenide is such that circularly polarized light will give you spin polarized excitation. So left circular would give you spin up, right circular would give you spin down, for example, like this. You can pump into the conduction band excess spin. And then by looking at the magnetization induced by that excess spin, as a function of time, it will cause Faraday rotation, which you measure, and you can look at the spin relaxation directly. Now, if you want to actually study the motion of the spins, you have to add some non-uniform spatial component to this excitation. So we do that by interfering two laser beams on the sample. Okay, so the angle of these two interfering laser beams will change the periodicity of the pattern created, thereby changing the Q vector of the excitation. So if you interfere two like polarized laser beams, you'll get electron hole pairs in a periodic arrangement modulated by the envelope of the laser spot itself. And if you use cross-polarized laser beams, you'll have a uniform intensity of the light, so you'll still have a uniform background of holes, but then you'll have a spin-polarized grating, a spin grating, where the excitation goes spin up, spin down across this laser spot. And to probe the grating, we send another laser beam through it, and most of the light is transmitted through. A small amount is diffracted off the grating. We measure that with a heterodyne technique, which I'll tell you more about later, which allows us to measure very small diffracted light signals, and then measure the decay of the grating. So the idea is to measure spin diffusion in the 2D electron gas and spin transport in the 2D electron gas. So this is just very simply modeled as diffusion with a loss term. The rate of decay of these spin gratings, or gratings of any type, should always go as Q squared, Q being obviously the inverse of the grating wavelength, and offset by some recombination rate of spins in this case. But in fact, when we do these experiments on a strongly spin orbit coupled 2D electron gas, we see something very different from dq squared. We see that this decay rate dips to almost zero at subfinite wave vector. So that's because the spin orbit coupling in the systems is very, very simple. Once you go into 2D, you have these terms, Rochebaugh and Dresselhaus, which are both linear in K and independently tunable in the gallium arsenide quantum wells. Rochebaugh can be tuned with the asymmetry of the growth of the well or with an external field. And the Dresselhaus can be tuned with the degree of confinement, right? It's coming from the asymmetry of the material itself, but then be tuned by the width of the quantum well. So it was pointed out long ago that when you have equal components of Rochebaugh and Dresselhaus whose spin orbit effective fields are of sort of opposite symmetry, you get a more symmetric state where it no longer, the spin orbit field and therefore spin precession no longer depends on the angle. And it also is proportional to the velocity of the moving spins. So it basically makes the spins, regardless of the speed and direction that they go, it makes them all precess in a way that their orientation is locked to their position. And therefore, if you set up a pattern like this, that has the right wavelength, the right wave vector, it shouldn't be able to decay because these spins can be bouncing around and colliding in different directions, but their orientation is always going to be locked to their position, and therefore this helix should live forever. And that, in fact, is what we saw in the measurements of spin diffusion that I showed you. So I can explain it a little bit more in detail here. At Q equals zero, the decay of spin in gallium arsenide is just exponential, okay, through three orders of magnitude. Once you go away from Q equals zero, once you start doing this transient grating experiment, you immediately start seeing bi-exponential decay. And that makes sense in terms of spin helices because the initial condition which you created, a spin grating of spin up, spin down, is in fact a linear combination of two different pitched helices, one rolling forward, one rolling backward. Only one of these will be enhanced by the spin orbit field, and the other will decay rapidly. So you see we've got a break of two different decay times at 50%, which makes sense in terms of this helix model. Okay, so as we change Q then, as we approach the wave vector of this special helix, we get a very, very, very long lifetime. So this was the picture I showed you before. These are the raw data. Different decay curves at different Qs. So here we actually have to change the angle of the interfering beam but this is all on the same sample. And we look at the decay times and rates, and you get this dip nearly to zero at the wavelength of this persistent spin helix, which is governed by the spin orbit coupling strengths. Okay, as you crank up the spin orbit coupling, this helix would, of course, get finer pitched. So from this, you can fit these data and you can obtain the spin orbit coupling parameters, which is not very interesting. This is all rather old stuff at this point. But from here, where we decided to go is to start looking at transport of these things. So we created samples where we could actually flow a current while doing these same experiments, okay? And this was actually non-trivial to create these samples in a way that we were able to do the experiments while flowing a current. But Louis Yang, a very good graduate student that we have that just graduated actually, spent a lot of time growing these samples. And we've been able to do some of these experiments. So if you imagine now you have a current flowing and you drop in a spin grating and we diffract light off of it, the light that's diffracted off of it is going to be Doppler shifted by the motion of the grating. And because we measure this interferometrically, we detect the spin grating not by looking at the intensity of the diffracted light, but we actually look at the amplitude and the phase of the diffracted light. We can measure that Doppler shift. So the amplitude portion gives us, the amplitude decay of this gives us the spin diffusion coefficient, and the phase advance would give us what you might call the spin mobility. So it's actually kind of funny the way this went down, because the student, Louis, spent so much time building these samples. It was a very big concern that flowing currents through them, high currents through them, was going to burn them out. So she did a whole set of experiments moving them at very, very low fields and locking in on the oscillating, in AC fields, locking in on the oscillating gratings and measuring the Doppler shift. And she was able to extract all of the relative transport parameters that way. And we published a paper about that. Joe and I had always been telling her, just crank up the voltage. Let's just crank up the voltage. But understandably, she didn't want to do this. So finally, when that was all done and we published that paper, we said, okay, now just let's apply a DC field. It would be so much easier to understand the experiment. And sure enough, she was able to crank the field way, way, way up and do a much easier experiment to interpret. So what this is now is a DC field and just simply doing this same spin grating experiment that I showed you in zero field. It's equivalent, this is showing essentially the out-of-plane spin at a point as a function of time as this grating is sliding by. Okay, so the wiggles are just the periodicity of the grating flying by our probe. As we increase the field, the grating moves faster and you get more wiggles. And of course it's decaying because of the recombination. So now we can just read off the velocity of the spin packet by looking at the peaks and troughs in our data and the times at which they occurred. And we can see that we're able to drift these things at 10 to the 7 centimeters per second, which is the Fermi velocity in this particular quantum well. So this is published now. I should have included a reference there. But this is the follow-up paper here. It's now finally published. So when we Fourier transform this, the wiggles become peaks, and we can see the two different helix modes in a different way, different frequencies as a function of field. That's what this extra structure is here before when I showed you the two different decay times corresponding to the two different helix modes. That's why there's extra structure in the wiggles, because there's still two modes there, one that decays very rapidly. And it turns out that they actually have different frequencies. Okay, so we can now extract the spin orbit, the transport parameters from the data. Okay, so the spin diffusion coefficient, which we don't actually have to have a field to measure, is shown here as a function of temperature, along with the transport measured charge diffusion coefficient. And you can see they're very, very different. This is an effect that is known, it's called spin Coulomb drag. The electron-electron interactions can reduce the spin diffusion coefficient relative to the charge diffusion coefficient via scattering events such as this, where the spin current has switched sign after the collision, but the charge current, of course, is not. All right, so this makes spins want to become stuck, essentially. And this can be a very strong effect. It can be up to a factor of 20, depending on the various parameters of the well. But in this case, it's a factor of 20. This is a very big effect. And then here's the spin mobility. So the charge mobility is in blue. And the spin mobility is in red. What I've written here is mu S0. So that's actually the spin mobility in the limit of zero laser intensity. Okay, so it's not actually surprising that this would be the same as the electron mobility. This is predicted. What is surprising at first is that the mobility that we measure depends on laser fluence. And this is the ambipolar mobility. So, of course, we can also measure the electron hole ambipolar transport by using the grating that has like polarized pulses as opposed to cross polarized pulses. So this is the plot showing the intensity, the laser intensity dependence of the mobility that we measure. And what's going on here is that both the electron hole pair and the spin excitation are neutral, and they're not affected directly by the E field that we're applying. What they are affected by is the current flowing in the Fermi gas that's present already. And it exerts a pressure on them, and that's what's driving them. So the pressure on the photoexcited carrier concentration, the pressure goes like the photoexcited carrier concentration. The pressure goes like the Fermi C carrier concentration, and the inertia of the packet goes like the photoexcited concentration. So the mobility that we measure goes like the ratio. So another interesting thing that comes out of this is that in these experiments, when we perform them, the two excitations actually separate from one another. So they're both getting pushed along by the Fermi C, but the charge excitation has to drag along the holes, which are much more massive. So it gets left behind, while the spin excitation flies on ahead at the electron velocity, at the electron mobility. Okay, so that's all I want to tell you about this spin helix work. Other stuff we're working on still is gate tuning of the Rochebaugh and looking for the spin Hall effect in these experiments. But that work is still ongoing. So I want to talk to you a little bit about some work I've done on the skirmion hosting materials. Okay, so these are, I studied the ones in particular that were itinerant helium magnets. So this is where you have the cooperation between ferromagnetic exchange and Dalashinsky-Maria interaction giving you long-range helix, which is incommensurate with the lattice. And these materials include iron cobalt silicon, manganese silicon, which also host this skirmion lattice. So those are the two that we started studying. And here's the phase diagram of iron cobalt silicon. So here you have, as a function of very low fields and temperature, a rich phase diagram with different forms of helium magnetism. The helical phase down here has true helices that are not canted and are pinned to the body diagonals of the cube. Okay. Once you get to a higher field, you depin these and start canting the spins and the constituent spins of the helix. And that's called the conical phase. And then at some intermediate temperature and field, you get this A phase. This is the skirmion lattice phase. So the experiment that we did on this was not this transient grating, okay, but was just the simple pump probe experiment. One pulse of pump exciting the sample, one pulse probing the sample, looking at either the reflectivity or the Kerr rotation of that pump pulse, probe pulse. So here's the reflectivity data. These are just delta R over R. That's the change in reflectivity induced by the pump pulse as a function of time delay and temperature. So as we cool down into the magnetic phase, you see a signal start to appear. That's because it's known that the magnetism in this material does change the reflectivity. And the effect of the pump pulse, once you get this magnetic order setting in, the effect of the pump pulse is to disturb the magnetic order. And that disturbance in the magnetic order reduces the reflectivity, and we can see that. That's what this big decay is. So we're able to see the demagnetization times, basically. And these are just showing this as a function of different fields, as a function of temperature. Now, it gets more interesting when you look at the Kerr rotation. So this is really looking at the magnetization of the sample. Okay, so these are different temperature scans at fixed field and a field scan at fixed temperature, okay, all within the interesting helium magnetic phase. And what you see is once you get down below a certain temperature and enter the helium magnetic phase, you start to get these small oscillations. They're not very easy to see the way I've plotted them here. But you can see the frequency is shifting with temperature and is clearly shifting with field. So the Kerr oscillations also have a frequency which is comparable to the Larmor precession in the critical field. Okay, so these things lead us to believe that these are specific to this helium magnetic phase. So here's a blow-up of one of the exemplary curves showing the oscillations. You can see them more clearly on this plot. It's the same data. And showing how we fit the data with a three-component fit. An exponential decay and an exponentially decaying oscillation. Okay, with all the same, it all has one decay time. There's only one decay time in the problem. Now, if you plot the frequencies as a function of field and temperature, all the curves do collapse onto each other. So we scale them by the zero field and zero temperature frequencies. And what's important here is that this field dependence is highly anomalous, that the frequencies actually decrease with increasing field. See, in a ferromagnet so the natural explanation for magnetic oscillations in this kind of experiment is that you're exciting magnons coherently. Okay, this is a well-known thing in ferromagnets that you can do. You hit it with a laser, coherently excite magnons either through ultrafast demagnetization or impulsive stimulated Raman scattering. But for a ferromagnet, when you increase the field, you always increase the frequency. So in a helium magnet, you have a different case. The wavelength of the helix shifts the magnon dispersion to finite Q. Okay, the optical measurement, we're not doing transient grating, remember, so the optical measurement is Q equals zero, basically. So we're stuck measuring here. Ordinarily, you would not see a finite frequency at zero field. So here we do, we see it up here, and then as you increase the field, the frequency actually decreases. We're able to fit it with this functional form, which was actually worked out specifically for helium magnons. This is just random and happens to work. Okay, but it does predict the TCs that agree with the neutron data and the magnetization data on these same samples. So we can also analyze the decay time, which is both the decay time for the oscillations and the non-oscillating curves, as a function of temperature, and relate them to the Gilbert damping. And so what we see is actually the Gilbert damping in this material is very, very high, especially when you compare to the Kupric selenide. This is the other material where people have seen these excitations. Takura's group saw them with microwave absorption. Except for ours are much more damped because it's an itinerant system. And so these would probably be too broad to see in this experiment. Now, likewise, they were able to see the excitations specific to the skirmion lattice itself. Okay, but their frequencies were very, very low, like a gigahertz. These are 5 gigahertz, basically. Okay, now in our system, we wouldn't be able to see those, it turns out, because, well, the gigahertz anyway, they're overdamped. Assuming that they would come in at a similar frequency, they would be overdamped. Of course, that's what we set out to see originally. So we've also started doing this in MNSI, which has a higher critical field, so it has a higher oscillation frequency. Okay, so the data actually looks much nicer. You can see more wiggles. It's much more clear. But what's interesting here is if you look, this exponential portion has the opposite sign to what we had in iron, cobalt, silicon. Okay, so that's very strange. So we then looked at the field dependence of this with switching the polarity of the field. Okay, and as it turns out, the iron, cobalt, silicon oscillations are odd in field. And in MNSI, they're even in field. So that would suggest a different excitation mechanism. Most likely what it is here, it almost has to be impulsive stimulated Raman scattering that's exciting these magnons. That's the only way that I can come up with that you can get even in field. And in this case, it's most likely resonant ultrafast demagnetization. So the idea here, right, is that you have this helix of spins. We put on a field that cants them. And that gives you a magnetization which we can see incur. When you hit it with the laser pulse, it demagnetizes. And since that is roughly resonant with the frequency of the magnons, you're able to launch this wave of magnons, okay? Whereas in the MNSI, you're really coupling directly to the spins. Not through a thermal or complicated effect like ultrafast demagnetization, right? That's a process with many different components leading to demagnetization, which is not understood perfectly well in every material. Okay, so I only have a few minutes left here. I'm just going to briefly show you a couple slides about iridates, which is something I said we've been working on. So we work closely with Ramesh's group doing oxide heterostructures, thin films of various iridates, and also James Analytis is a new professor we have at Berkeley who's growing single crystals. He has some very nice new single crystals, which I can't talk about for a few more weeks, so hopefully the next time you see me talk, I'll have some very interesting results on those. But I can tell you about a couple things real quickly. Strain-controlled strontium iridate 113 film. So the idea with iridates, I guess no one's really talked about it yet, is that it's strongly spin-orbit coupled system because of the iridium, but it's also strongly correlated. So we do a lot of correlated electrons and spin-orbit coupling, so this is sort of right up our alley. So with the 113 films, what they're doing is changing the strain. So this was done by Jian Liu and Ramesh's group. They grow it on different substrates. The films are so thin that they can really strain them by changing the substrate that they grow it on. And that they've noticed that that changes the resistivity drastically as you go from compressive to tensile strain. And it also changes the infrared spectra, which I measured looking at this sort of peak related to the spin-orbit coupling in this material. Okay, I don't want to go into lots of detail, but that peak, the overall reflectivity changes as you add strain, and the peak position also shifts. So this is something we're actively working on and interested in collaborating with people on. Another one is growing pyrochlore iridate thin films. So we've successfully, Jinhao Chu in Ramesh's group has been able to grow both bismuth iridate and lead iridate, both pyrochlore films. We've done second harmonic generation, for example, on the lead iridate. This is where you use the high intensity fields of the pulse lasers to do nonlinear optics. And the inversion symmetry breaking of lead iridate leads to this process being allowed. And what the symmetry, as you rotate the polarization, this is showing a polar plot of the intensity of this effect as you change the polarization incident on the sample. This plot uniquely determines the point group of the lead iridate. And the in the bismuth iridate, I guess the interesting thing that they've recently found is that there may be some magnetism at very, very low temperature. This is magnetoresistance measurements, and they've seen at the very lowest temperature some hysteresis. But again, the tricky part here is that these things are all films on substrates. And I've worked on these a lot, and the substrate always matters. So we're not sure about this yet. But there is some evidence that there might be potentially time reversal symmetry breaking. And in this material, that could mean you the possibility of this vial semi-metal state. So another set of iridates that we're working on is just the 214s. This is the spin orbit coupled mod insulator. So again, Ramesh's people with yet another student have grown thin films of this. And we've been able to do the infrared spectroscopy and it's seen these telltale peaks showing the transitions between these spin orbit Mott bands. We've also done preliminary X-ray scattering here. This is at the image done at the ALS. And this is some time-resolved pump probe data with just 1.5 EV light. The idea here is to move to the time-resolved X-ray facility that we have at ALS and pump these things, hopefully resonant with these transitions, and see how they change the absorption spectra or possibly do scattering off of the magnetic structures that exist in there. So I'm probably out of time now. So thank you very much. I'll take questions.
So for your measurement, like you can measure spin diffusion constant, compared to the charge diffusion constant measured from the hard measurement, how accurate are your measurement?
How accurate are they?
Yeah, how accurate?
Well, there's the difference, I don't know exactly what you're getting at. The difference in the charge diffusion coefficient and the spin diffusion coefficient is a factor of 20. So the measurement is, that is way beyond the accuracy of our measurements. So I actually had error bars on this plot, but they're hard to see. They're very small. One second. There. So this is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So the error bars on here are very rapidly getting smaller than the data points. So if there's some systematic error that leads to this being wrong, it's a possibility, but you know, we're talking about a factor of 20. It's a pretty huge effect, and we've seen it in many different wells with different doping levels, different values of D, different values of mu. There's always some level of this effect that we're able to detect.
Yeah, actually, I don't like dot this result. I just like, if we want to like use the spin dynamics to measure something, so how accurate we can get from?
Oh, well, right. You mean how? So it depends on the pitch of the grating that you're able to make. And so we're able to make a grating that goes, you're limited by the wavelength of the light. So at 800 nanometers, that's 1.5 EV, you could conceivably make a grating that was just about a micron. A little lower, but practically speaking, you can't do that. So if the diffusion in the time frame that you can measure, if the diffusing entities that you're measuring can go that far, you will be able to see it. And so we've done these experiments, for example, in cuprate superconductors. And there you could barely see it. And the reason is because the recombination is just about as fast as the diffusion at those wave vectors. So you just have to be in a regime where diffusion goes faster than recombination at that wave vector. And then you can see it. I mean, the measurement itself is very precise in that you can measure diffracted light fields on the order of 10 to the minus 8 from where you started by heterodyne detection. But what diffusion coefficient you can measure really, really depends on these other things. The time scale of the recombination. If you want to go, so one idea for extending the technique to measure more things would be to go to higher energy of the light, lower wavelength of the light, so you can get a higher pitched grating, a finer pitched grating. You could even imagine going to X-rays. People have been talking about doing that. But then, of course, you're also generating all sorts of other excitations. You become resonant with atomic levels and things like this. But those are the things that you have to consider for being able to measure diffusion.
I wanted to ask if it's at all conceivable to combine the first and second part of your talk to do a grading experiment on one of these skirmion lattice states to try and look for commensurability between the Q of the grading and the period of the skirmion lattice.
The period of the skirmion lattice is that so that we can only do a grading down to a micron with 800 nanometer light.
It might still be an effect if the, you know, even if the period of the light is some multiple of the.
Yeah, right. No, it's certainly something we can do. Now you can't necessarily generate a spin grading. Right. You can do an intensity grading. The helicity grading of the light might not generate a spin grading. In fact, I doubt it does. I'm sure it doesn't. But you can definitely do transient grading measurements. So if you, this is a good thing to think about ways that we might be able to use it. We're certainly always interested in discussing that. So
could you actually also make like a spin Hall effect with your spin grading?
Well,
because
it
seems like a natural thing, yeah?
Yeah, we've actually worked with Victor on that already. He calculated the proper parameters that we would need to optimize that effect. So the idea would be, okay, so all the stuff I showed you was making a spin grading, moving it that way, and measuring it, right? The idea here would be making a spin grading and moving it that way, and that would make the peaks and troughs of the grading move towards, apart or towards each other. I used to have a slide about this, in fact. I've thought about it enough that I actually have a slide about it. But then the Coulomb repulsion would make charge pile up, and you would start with a spin grading, and as you moved it, the spin Hall effect would generate a charge grading. And we can measure those two. We can distinguish between them because diffraction off of one involves a polarization flip, and diffraction off of another does not. So we actually have everything we need to do that experiment. And Victor was actually asking me about it in the coffee break. So we definitely need to do that. I mean, we basically have everything to do it. And the idea would be that we, in these very clean systems with very high mobility and high carry density, we probably measure the intrinsic effect. Yeah, so we're going to do that.
There's a question here. Yeah, you said that you can observe the spin structure in the X-ray regime, right? But in the X-ray regime, you can observe the magnetizer structure.
You're talking about the iridates?
I'm not expert, so I couldn't follow. But you apply X-ray and observe some magnetizer structure, is it?
Yeah. If you're talking about the very last part of the talk, because these are all near IR experiments that I was showing, except for this one little thing at the end here.
Anyway, my question is very naive, and if X-ray has a high energy, so I thought that it distorts all the magnetic structure, the X-ray energy is too high much higher than SD interaction or other interactions, so I didn't think you can see some magnetization structure, but is it not?
Yeah, I wasn't the case? Necessarily, so okay, I'm not 100% sure. If you're talking about what we were talking about with this question here and doing transient grading with X-rays, or if you're referring to doing magnetic X-ray scattering in strontium iridate. Yeah, okay, so that's X-rays can scatter off of a magnetic structure with a well-defined periodicity. If you tune resonant to the transition of the species a transition that involves electrons that are part of that structure, then you can scatter, and that Q vector will be the Q vector of the magnetic pattern. So this material is known to have some magnetic structure that we can scatter off of. And the idea would be then, if you want to do a time-resolved experiment, you could pump it and, say, disturb that structure and watch how the scattering changes as a function of time. That's a rather unique capability that you can only do at a free electron laser like the LCLS or at the femtoslicing beamline at the advanced light source that we have at Berkeley. So that's something that's pretty widely done now is resonant magnetic scattering.
I think you mentioned it, I think in connection with your manganese silicate, you said you were surprised that you had a signal which was even in magnetic field. Couldn't that be simply magnetic linear dichroism? Did you check that?
I didn't check that, actually.
Did you look at the dependence of your signal, of your rotation on the angle of the probe pulse?
We did do that. We changed the field. So we actually did this in a very simple way. We had a permanent magnet that we calibrated on stages behind our sample. We didn't even do this in a superconducting magnet. These fields are very low. So we were able to just move the field around. So we were able to move the field around the crystal. We were able to move the crystal as well, relative to the light. And none of this really changed at all in doing so, actually. But, you know, once you get into this conical phase, I guess the canted helix pretty much is pointing along the field. And our experiment is pretty much sensitive to whatever component of the magnetization is along the light trajectory. So as long as you're in an orientation where there's both of those things, you see the same thing.
Okay, any further questions? If not, I'd like to thank all of the speakers this afternoon for a wonderful set of talks.